Welcome to another episode of The Gateway. My name is Russ, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts Amin and Biagio. For this episode, The Gateway is excited to welcome Dr. Anna Kliss. Anna earned her PhD from the University of Texas at Austin in May 2015 and joined Northern Illinois University the following August. Anna is a microeconomist who applies the techniques of game theory to questions about public economics and externalities. She is also a faculty associate with the NIU Institute for the Study of the Environment, Sustainability, and Energy, as well as the School for Public and Global Affairs. Anna, welcome to The Gateway. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am, as always with my guests, very excited, but I think I can even be more excited because as an NIU professor and as someone who pursues things that I'm tangentially interested in, I'm like very invested in this conversation. So again, thank you. But I want to begin this conversation like I always do with your background. How did you get to where you are? What's your story?
Oh my gosh. we have to go back quite a while. So I'm an economist, but economics is not something that you really like learn about early on, right? It's not.
Yeah, you're not at the playground being like, I want to be an economist.
No. So, and even in high school, a lot of high schools have a required course in economics, but it's oftentimes not a really deep delve into the subject, and you don't get this full-on experience of what the discipline actually has in it. So going into college, I actually was pretty convinced I wanted to be a journalist kind of to study maybe international politics or something like that. And as part of my required courses, I had to take some economics courses. Now, in high school, I had taken macroeconomics. I had taken the AP test, did well on that, but I didn't really enjoy the subject. It, frankly, was kind of boring. and so then I was taking microeconomics, and it was really clicking. I had a professor, Professor Marius Schwartz, where he... After the first midterm, he wrote on my midterm at the top, "See me." And I was terrified. I was like, oh no, what's going on? No, I had just done really well on the midterm. And he mentioned, like, you should consider economics as a major. And it's like a light bulb went off. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So technically, my major was international economics, but I was really drawn even then to sort of the theory, to writing down economic situations as thematical models, managed to get essentially the department to offer a class that they weren't going to offer that year. They offered it the previous year. I missed out on that one. I got a bunch of students to like together my senior year, and we were like, hey, please, can you offer this thing? Because I just wanted more theoretical economics there. Yeah, managed to do that. I did graduate in 3 years. I had a lot of AP credit and not a ton of money. So my parents were really like, yes, please, please, please try to finish fast. Right. And then I'd known I wanted a PhD for a really long time. So my dad has a PhD in chemistry. My mom has a master's in chemistry and in library sciences. She was working on her PhD back in the day, but... she had a voice handicap, essentially. At some point, she lost her voice completely. And they were in Poland, and there wasn't such a thing as like a disabilities act. And so she literally had to drop out of her program.
Wow.
And so I've seen, they weren't professors. They were research assistants. But I got to see that sort of academic life growing up, and I was really into it. I was like, yes, this is, I like this. And so I knew early on that I wanted a PhD. It could have been in anything. And then it just so happened, like, all right, it's econ. I'm going into econ. So then I went from finishing my undergrad at Georgetown to then UT Austin to studying economics there. And then after graduating with my PhD, I'm here at Northern Illinois. So I've been here 9 years now, and it's been a great time.
That is awesome. I love all of those things, and thank you for that general roadmap to how to become a
Yeah.
professor in
It's just one
economics.
of many roadmaps.
Yes, ma'am.
People take lots of different paths to get to professordom. Mine just happened to be a pretty quick path.
Yes, which I will say lends to your work ethic and your overall ability. So good job there.
Thank you.
I would like to start at the basics and not necessarily macro versus microeconomics, but more of your working definition of economics, theoretical versus apply, where you're coming from, because I think most of the population thinks of it as, well, there's supply versus demand. It's that new Geico commercial of like a bunch of people being like, what's the economy? And you're like, oh, it's the thing we all know about, and no one has a clue. And then when someone like yourself goes to pursue it, you start realizing it's a very broad tent with a lot of social science and like all of the different elements in there. So where do you come from like a working definition?
Sure. So economics is the study of human decision making. Now, I say that, and somebody might immediately say, wait, isn't that psychology? What are you talking about?
Right.
So, psychology approaches understanding human decision making, human brains from a biological point of view, and from a kind of social norms, social development, that sort of idea. Economics approaches it from incentives. So, from thinking of what are your benefits of a decision, what are your costs of a decision, and whereas instead of looking at it from a biological, what's going on in your brain sort of way, we almost think about the way things should be if you kind of wrote them down mathematically, weighing them this side and that side. Now, sometimes people get that confused with like being logical or being this like emotionless human being,
Right.
essentially. And
Yes.
so we do have a term called rational. We do have that as a term, but it doesn't mean cold and calculating. It doesn't mean not taking into account your feelings. Rational in economics is a mathematical term. It means that your preferences are complete and transitive, and that in your behavior, you're trying to do the best you can. So complete means that given sort of any set of choices you could make, you could point at any two and say, this one's better than that one, or that one's better than this one. You essentially don't have somebody like looking at pizza versus tacos tonight and just like never ever able to make a decision. That's the first part. That's complete. It's just that you can make a decision. And it's okay if things are tied. That's fine. It's just that you're not going to die of hunger because
You're
you just got
frozen.
stuck. Yeah, exactly. So it's almost thinking about like, can this program execute as a person?
I see. When you're saying the good or like the best choice, is that does that consider like
The best you can
morals?
do,
You get what I'm at, like the
happiest. It
ethics?
can't,
Okay.
you can consider morals and ethics. But when we say best, we oftentimes mean the most utility. And utility is a faux concept. No economist actually thinks that people are running around with like functions in their head that they're trying to like make the largest possible. But it's something that we use in place of. So, I mean, you can decide if something makes you happy or not. And for some people, being moral makes them happy. Like
And vice
being
versa.
moral,
Like
and for
there's
some
some.
people, doing something immoral makes them happy.
Got
So
it.
best
Not me.
choice is a Not you.
Not me.
That's good to know.
But like you can embed all sorts of things in there. So for people that are like, well, Homo economicus means that somebody is uncaring. No, you can build in caring for your family and caring for your friends and caring for the environment. Those can all be built into your utility. I am happy when the world is clean and safe and doing well. To me, it's just sort of funny whenever somebody says like, oh, you got to be all this rational sort of thing, as if like, no, come on, preferences are defined on like, do you like pizza? Pizza's
Right.
delicious. Pizza's
Yes.
delicious.
Especially with pineapple. Call out to Biagio.
Oh,
Incorrect.
Oh, he
No,
wishes he was here.
pineapple on pizza. But all of our decision making, the supply demand stuff, that comes from the fact that people like pizza or like tacos or need to buy apples today or need to buy all of that stuff is derived from this. So of course there's emotions in it. It's just that at some point, once you start building in a lot of forms of happiness, the world is a really complicated place and we can only handle so much complication in our mathematical models. So we might abstract away from, if we don't think that this particular problem we're studying involves something like morals and ethics, we're maybe talking about like grocery store decisions. It's not really an ethical dilemma. Well, okay, I suppose you could find an ethical dilemma anywhere, but it's not
Right.
really an ethical dilemma to decide, how many bananas you want to buy, how many apples you want to buy. But then when we study problems where we think such things matter, so for instance, when we maybe study how people plan for their lifetime wealth. So they want to plan ahead to be able to pay for their college, the tuition of their kids. Or when we study like how do people make environmental decisions, we will build those back into the model and then try to study how that works. So that's kind of economics overall. With
Can
regards
I
to,
just real
yeah,
fast? I want
sure.
to, without making a bunch of professors in economics scream around the world, to simplify it, is am I understanding it as more of like a pro and con list in a formula for a given decision, or am I way off
Yeah,
base?
it's kind of like that. And we see that sort of structure in a lot of individual economic tools. So, for instance, the
Understood.
benefit cost analysis is literally list the benefits on one side, list the cost on the other side. You just try to be really comprehensive about it.
I
Um,
see.
and and yeah, if you were to be thinking then to really kind of amp up your quote unquote rational decision making, it shouldn't be that you like turn into some sort of like fitness machine that's drinking Soylent powder or like doing all that. No, it's just you really need to think about what makes you happy. So does this thing make me happy? Will this thing make me happy in the long run? What's the cost here? And then it's okay. It's good to spend maybe an extra hour sleeping if you know that, like, if I get up too early or if I go to bed too late, I'm gonna feel like crap tomorrow.
Right.
But if you're doing something really fun, like you're hanging out with your friends and it's only every once in a while, then you might say, well, that's worth it more to me this time. So it's always thinking about like, what could I be doing that is gonna make me happy and what could make me happy in the long run?
Amazing. I think that is a very beneficial way to look at economics. And I apologize, I interrupted you. So where were you going to go on like more of the
Oh,
theoretical
yeah.
then? Is that
Yes. So you
okay?
were asking earlier about theoretical versus applied. And so theoretical, m most of econ is actually applied economics at this point. Like most economists are some sort of applied economist. They use econometrics, which is essentially the studies of using data, using large data sets, and positing relationships among that data, and then testing those relationships through regressions, essentially. So economists, there are economic experiments. They are small. They are similar to psychological experiments. They're not going to get at the same types of questions that we can get at with really large macroeconomic and labor and other data sets. And so then you can't really do some types of experiments like, what am I going to do? Change the interest rate here and see what happens? That's not how that works. So I can't really run an experiment, but you can collect data on interest rates and you can collect data on how people react to things. And then you can try to study the relationships between them. So that's most economists. I am not an econometrician. I am a theorist, a game theorist. And so what that means is that before we even get to data, I try to write down stories as mathematical models. I then solve those mathematical models, look at what sorts of implications there are, and sort of then translate them back into the story. So by phrasing it this way, what kind of information could I derive? And then what can that tell me from the story?
That's fascinating to hear. So it is really not hard. So you mentioned microeconomics, right? Mm-hmm. According to your bio as well. It's not hard to see the connection between macroeconomics and politics, right? And what is the connection between microeconomics and politics? Because economics is very political, right?
Sure. So here's the other thing that most people don't know about economics. Most economists are microeconomists. In fact, very few economists are actually, well, not very few, but macroeconomics is a smaller subfield than all of the rest of the stuff put together. So if somebody's a labor economist, they might be looking at, they're usually looking at individual employment or firm decisions. And then, yes, they're drawing parallels to that, to the macro side, what kind of that does on the macro scale. But in fact, most of us are studying individual decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
So to then understand how that connects to policy, if you want to think about, so some, you know, there's a policy proposed, you want to know how people are going to react. So for instance, if you are going to charge a tax on something like a sugary beverage, then you want to know, okay, why am I doing that? Okay, I guess on some level you think sugary beverages are bad overall for people's health. You'd like to disincentivize them from buying them. And then on the other hand, you are also perhaps raising some tax revenue for something else. So there's kind of two things there. Well, then you want to know, how are people going to react? Are they actually going to buy fewer sugary beverages? Are they going to buy the same amount of sugary beverages and then you're going to get a ton of tax money? Or are they going to drive out of the county and buy their sugary beverages elsewhere? Like we literally saw when Cook County introduced their soda tax, essentially. And then repealed it because it was a policy that people really, really didn't enjoy. So understanding those micro decisions that people are making helps you then understand whether a policy is going to actually work. And then you can think about before you implement a policy, you can also evaluate a policy after the fact. So what did this manage to do? Did we manage to improve people's health, or did we just manage to make a lot of people mad?
So I always envision microeconomics as like the finance, like what are you doing with your bank account? Like, and again, I've taken one class in it and I hated it, which is why I was like, Anna likes microeconomics. This is really good to learn about. But you're really saying it's an individual choice, but then you're extrapolating that to a larger impact on society. Like you're not doing a report on what Steve's choice was and how Steve's life was impacted. Like at some point you're trying to evaluate a larger impact of a policy or a decision. Is that right? I guess I'm still a little confused on the difference between micro and macro. And sadly, that's what I think most of us view economics in, is those are the two things, if you even know that much.
Sure. So micro is all about the individual decision maker. So that could be a consumer, that could be a firm, that could be a country. So I have examined countries as individual decision makers when they're, for instance, making their policy versus other countries or choosing whether or not to sign an agreement. So that's what micro is about. And you essentially set up the utility function, the one that kind of brings in the benefits and the costs of what's going on. You analyze the behavior, and then you might find like how people are acting in an equilibrium. Now, macro, what it does is it's no longer about the individual. It's about the system. So we might look at an individual, like a representative person's decision making, but then macro has specific ways to essentially aggregate that behavior. So what happens when a ton of people all make their decisions in this way? And then you study the movement of the patterns overall. So they're not as different from sort of the foundations. Macro usually comes from micro foundations. But once you start adding up all those people, you essentially then macroeconomists start looking at the overall patterns in the economy. So it's kind of like the difference between thinking about, if you were at a farmer's market and you were trying to haggle with somebody for the price of the tomatoes versus you went to Schnucks and you looked at the price of tomatoes. Like that price of tomatoes at Schnucks came from somewhere else. It came from kind of the overall market. It's not like Schnucks is doing their best to just price them according to something fair, according to what's going on in the market, versus at the farmer's market, you're kind of working on that individual level. And so, yeah, you are still using the lessons that you learn from a micro setup to then try to understand how different policies might interact. I, for instance, so as a game theorist, I look at strategic situations, so where the actions impact each other. And so, for instance, if I'm considering like whether a country will join an environmental treaty, I also want to think about like, okay, what is this other country doing? Like, do I want to bind myself to reduce my emissions if nobody else is going to do it with me? And so that's the kind of problems that then you can study overall. It's funny earlier that you mentioned kind of like finances, that sort of thing. I barely ever touch dollars. I barely
Right.
ever touch like real numbers. I work with like variables, essentially, Greek letters, representations.
Professor Cliz,
So
I have learned so much already. Like, I didn't even realize, because I'll make a lot of decisions, or sometimes I'll look at, do I need to make a decision on if everyone did this thing, would it be a problem? Like, if everyone took a grape from a grocery store, would that be a problem? Yes, because then no one would have grape. Like, they would all be stolen, but at an individual letter, it doesn't know, it's a one grape, right? Like, I use that all the time. I didn't realize that this is, I'm learning. Thank you. Yeah.
And
And
I'm gonna shut up.
Amin,
Oh,
you were trying to kind of bring it to politics. One thing that I can say is then
always.
if you think about like the problem of your individual vote, I mean,
Yeah.
yes, it's really easy to get kind of disheartened and nihilistic thinking about like, well, what does my one vote matter? I'm not going to be pivotal in
In
anything.
Illinois, yeah.
Well, whichever state you're a part of, everybody feels that way. Like, I think you'd have to be in one of those like tiny towns, like that first town that votes, that's
Yeah.
like six people or whatever. Okay, fine. Then you might think your vote actually like really matters. But everywhere else, it can feel like your vote doesn't. The thing is that then you can think about all the people that are kind of like you, or all the people that have similar preferences to you. And if you think about, okay, if I'm feeling this way and everybody else is feeling similarly, and then we all don't show up, that's where you can then see how everybody with your preferences might not be heard in the democracy. So then I still think it's sort of very important to, okay, the benefits overall, the sort of I gotta keep strong and kind of think that like, yeah, something's gonna matter, especially if there are other people like me out there as well who I'm hoping that they go vote also.
I 100% agree. That's how in 2014 the Republican governor got elected in the state, I believe. Everyone said, I don't matter. I'm just gonna stay. And
I wasn't
yeah,
here in 2014 yet. I moved to Illinois in
me neither.
2015. So, yeah.
But
I'm the only one, guys. It was it was
Do you
interesting.
remember?
That's all I'm gonna say. That's all I'm
I
gonna say.
just knew someone. I just knew someone who worked in Pat Quinn's campaign, and that's how I knew. But you have talked about environment, and I see environment in your bio as well. So, yes or no question: are we going to be okay or not?
Wow.
Just simple, yes or no. I know there is
I
so much
can't
emissions. It's hard to answer yes or no.
That's not very
No.
helpful,
I
Anna. That doesn't
know.
make me feel good.
Well,
So how
because
about scenarios?
I think here's my answer. A lot of us will be fine.
Okay.
A lot of people won't. And that's the thing. We have to worry about the people that won't be okay.
Okay.
So, I mean,
I
here in
see.
Illinois, for instance, we are not next to an ocean. We're
Thank
not.
God.
So, rising sea levels aren't going to delete our coastline because we don't have a coastline to begin with. We will experience more flooding, likely. But again, and then on the flip side, Illinois is also an area that has been always pretty rich in groundwater resources as well. And so we aren't suffering the same sorts of scarcity and droughts that other places in the world might feel. We might get colder, or we might get, I mean, even the 9 years that I've been here, I've seen that the summers have gotten shorter and a little later. And meanwhile, our winter has gotten milder at the beginning and then just really nasty in like April and even early May. So our patterns are going to change that way, which is then changing the way that farmers are doing things. There's a field near my house. It is not my field, but I do think of it as our neighborhood field. And I've been sort of observing, like, okay, there was that year where there was a ton of rain. They just waited. They didn't plant until like June. And then they chose to plant soy instead of corn because, well, initially a lot of people weren't planting soy because there were the extra tariffs that we had upon like the retaliatory tariffs. And so people were worried that the market for soy was down. But because they waited and fewer people had planted soy, now they could actually fill a need there. And also, soy has a slightly shorter growing season than corn. So, you know, just even seeing that reaction to both climate change and economic conditions, like in real life as it was happening, was really interesting. Will humanity be okay as a species? I have no reason to think we won't be unless there's some sort of external catastrophic event. But I think that the real problem is not necessarily worrying about yourself, but worrying about people that are living in water scarce regions, about worrying about people who live in on island nations. And those people are going to need homes. We can't abandon them.
Yeah,
So then,
we won't be isolated from their problems.
yeah, so then they're going to seek new homes, and then we're going to see essentially migration crises and those sorts of things. Now, I will also say is that I think in some of the models of like research, technological research, sometimes you have these kind of like optimal stopping models, which I think those show up in operations as well, where you sort of continue an action until you get to this threshold of like, okay, now I should stop. And I think that for a long time, the fact about climate change has been talked about for
Yeah.
decades, but it wasn't as salient a problem. And so you had sort of larger businesses just continue. It wasn't
Yeah.
their optimal time to stop yet because they were still hoping that there was going to be some magical technology that comes around that can like reverse things really quickly. And maybe that's still out there. I don't know. I don't know anything. But now,
Yeah.
as the time horizon gets shorter for the damages, you can see even these larger companies really start to think like, oh, okay, if we ruin everything, there won't even be a market for us to work on.
Yeah.
Or they start thinking about like, okay, looks like governments are going to start making new regulations. We need to preempt those by just starting to change our behavior now so that it's not as costly in the future. So I think we're already in the portion of time where the damages from climate change are visible. And yeah, whether we'll be okay depends on your definition of okay.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Amin. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I saw a comment from I think it was a paper actually, published somewhere, of course, in 1800s, that someone said, an engineer said, it can possibly not be sustainable. And they actually used the word sustainable, taking things out of the ground and burning. We can't continue this forever, probably. They were saying that. But exactly, I don't know, in my opinion, or in a lot of people's opinion, it's not an expert opinion, of course. We have reached the optimal stopping point a few decades ago or even earlier, but a lot of people are like, who are raking in a lot of money, they
Well,
haven't
so
reached the optimal point
that's
stopping.
the other big lesson of kind of the problems that I study, which is thinking about what is optimal from a social point of view versus what is optimal from an individual point of view. And it was kind of like Russ was saying about taking a grape from the grocery store bunch. Like, it might be a good action for you individually. You get some joy out of it. But if everybody does it, then that's yeah, the grapes are gone and the store is out of money. I mean, stealing one grape is still, in some sense, stealing. And so when we're talking about, like, yeah, we probably reached the optimal stopping point socially a while ago, but for an individual firm, they're not being incentivized heavily enough to switch away from these things. And individual people, it's one of the things that when, for instance, so I often have students from environmental studies, and one of the things that frustrates a lot of them is sometimes the language around like, oh, everybody needs to do their part. And that's true, everybody does, but me having one plastic straw is not going to kill all the turtles. And even a lot of us having a plastic straw, if we make sure that they are disposed of correctly, it's also not going to kill all the turtles. But on the other hand, we do have agents that have outsize effect on everybody else, and their marginal actions are the ones that have kind of gotten us into this mess.
And they are shielded from paying for the damages. I think that is the problem because,
Yes, the way that the legal structures have gone, especially with Supreme Court rulings over the past couple of years, et cetera, the incentive system is totally warped. They get shield essentially from their damages.
The electric company that gives me my electricity, I can't control what how they make their electricity, and whatever the cost of their emissions is not they're not going to pay for it. So why wouldn't they use the cheapest one that is available to them?
Well, and it's
Exactly.
funny that we use the shield. I mean, even in contracts or mergers and acquisitions, whatever it is, there's liability shields. They're building those in to be like, if something goes bad, because we're doing it the cheapest way possible, and people might be impacted negatively, or the Exxon Valdez might crash into and spill thousands of gallons of oil, even though we know might not have been the best, or the person we hired might not have been the best to drive it. We're covered. We're good. Like, it's fine.
Or, for
One.
instance, the bailouts after the 2008 financial crisis, essentially, where it was the firms that were taking on this extra risky behavior, and then they don't have to face the consequences of their own failure because they're too big to fail. We have to bail them out. It's different. It's very different than bailing out, for instance, industries that are experiencing a shock that's not of their own making. Like, for instance, when we did a lot of things about COVID was a shock that the industries themselves did not make. And so, yeah, we definitely should have supported bars and restaurants even more so that they could close and come back afterwards. And those sorts of things. But when it's literally of your own making and then you also get bailed out, that's just limiting the incentives for the future. It's just saying, yep, we're going to bail you out in the future as well. It doesn't matter if you take bad actions now.
Yeah, I do too. No, but makes
So,
sense.
Anna, I then wonder, and I'm going back to the beginning of years of kind of evaluating rational or trying to define how do you define rational in your research, or if that's a dumb question, everyone has their own definition of rational. If because like
oh,
again,
no,
a
no,
firm,
no, no. So
no, or am
rational,
I, yeah,
rational
please.
is complete and transitive. I'm just gonna stick with that. Rational means complete and transitive. So you can make a choice, and then your choice orders make sense. So if you like A better than B and B better than C, you like A better than C. That's rational. With regards to then what goes into somebody's utility, like what makes people the best off. So when I am modeling countries or modeling individuals, I try to understand the situation and think about what pieces will benefit versus cost. So I do this pretty generally. And by generally, I mean writing down letters instead of like specific functional forms. But so for instance, if we're thinking about emissions, I might write down a function where there's a benefit of emissions and there's a cost of emissions. And I won't get much more specific than that, at least in that problem. Meanwhile, either another researcher or maybe myself in the future could write down a more specific form of that. So for instance, like literally try to write down like the costs are minus the cost times emissions squared or something like that. But I'll keep it really general. I'll just think about the shape of the function. Yeah, it's increasing. So as emissions goes up, you get more benefits. As emission goes up, you get more costs. It's probably concave. So that means you've got this diminishing marginal benefit. Okay, benefits go up, but at a diminishing rate. And then that's kind of what I'll study. So what sort of shape, what sort of pattern to this benefit affects different things. Sometimes you can get more specific, sometimes not.
Is that how you attempt to remove your own personal biases, or I'm thinking of more of like the social or like biological side of things, where you try and do a blind experiment or a double blind, like so you're not unintentionally doing it by keeping it broad. Is that what you're trying to remove? Or then I go back into the politics side of things, where we have think tanks and a lot of people come out with using the term economy or economist or economic research, and you can definitely see biases on again both sides. I hate saying that out loud, but
yeah, so that's I haven't really thought of it that way in terms of removing personal bias. It's more that I'm interested in a very small piece of the problem, and I don't know the true function.
Oh.
And if I don't know it, I shouldn't just go around making something up. That's definitely what it is. Now, when I posit the shape, it's a really general understandable shape, sort of going up, but at a decreasing rate. And even then, sometimes I'll study different forms of the shape. Like what if it isn't going up? What if it's going down? Or what if it's here or there? So it's almost more of this like academic humility about that. Now, there are think tanks out there that they will have data and they might try to estimate what it looks like. But again, as part of that academic humility, like I also don't want to assert that this is the function to be all functions and this is the one in all situations. So for instance, even if we, you know, followed you around, Russ, and wrote down all your preferences and like had some really thorough interviews and observed your purchasing behavior for years, and really modeled out your function, who's to say that then a mean has the same function? Or who's to say that a mean's function is even the same shape? Now, again, sometimes that's what makes sense. Sometimes you're trying to study people over at large, and so you posit a shape, and then you try to investigate, like, if this shape is right, what's this parameter here? But again, you as part of the economic discussion, you essentially have to be pretty upfront about your assumptions. And so I would say that to figure out whether somebody is kind of an academic, a more academic think tank, or whether somebody's a more partisan or kind of maybe a trying to sell you a point of view, it's how open they are about their assumptions. Academics are going to tell you, these were my assumptions in the problem. this is why this assumption makes sense. This is why this assumption might not make sense. If this assumption broke, here's what would happen in the model. This is why I assumed this. And then you can kind of go in and see like, yeah, that makes sense. All right. Okay. If these assumptions hold, this result is what happens. Versus if somebody's like hiding it from you, if somebody like, you know, assumed a crazy function and then says, oh, I found that all people act like this, but they didn't tell you about their crazy function. They're trying to sell you something. They're not doing good economics. They're not doing good academics.
I was just taking all of that in. Okay.
I hope that made sense.
It totally did. It totally did. Don't take my pause as that was... I'm then thinking about where we get into as at least in America or more Western culture, if our currencies shift, because a lot, even in your example about following me around, you're talking about my purchase decisions, those ones. Can economics still exist if we don't have a traditional capitalistic or I give you money and that? Like, what happens if we didn't have a society without money? We went back to hunters and gatherers. Would you still be able to do your work if we didn't have a traditional capitalistic society?
No, macro question.
Yeah, sorry, so I told you I didn't like micro.
One of the first things that you learn about in like micro principles even is the idea of why having a currency helps efficiency. And not necessarily from like a, I'm not talking about necessarily like a cutthroat business efficiency, like minimized cost, but even just in making things work, making things flow smoother. If we don't have a currency, you have to have a double coincidence of wants. So if I want eggs, I need to go to a farmer that has chickens, and I need to have something to offer that farmer of value. Hey, I'll teach you about economics. Maybe. That's a little bit less useful in that context, but I've got some other skills. So like maybe I could, you know, paint your fence or paint something for you there. That's a really hard system. That's a really, really hard system to operate in, because, and especially in our modern day, when so many of us don't make things at home, we are not home producers, and our skills are kind of more advanced. And it's not that they're not useful. That's not what I'm trying to say, but they are less visibly beneficial kind of on an individual, like that they benefit somebody else particularly. So, I mean, that's why money is not a modern invention. Money's been around since right. ancient times,
mm-hmm.
Whether people are trading gold pieces, because it's essentially a way to fix that. Like, okay, I want some eggs. The farmer doesn't want an economics lesson, but maybe they want this piece of gold that I have. And so that doesn't even depend on having a central bank. That just depends on having something that people agree upon has a value. So I don't think money's going away. I don't think we're going back to a barter system. I mean, you know, maybe in a dystopian science fiction novel where, you know, something has happened. But even then, people will trade things that they can offer. And can I do my job in such a system? Probably not. There's not a lot of value for a theoretical economist in kind of the zombie apocalypse wasteland. So I will have to get better at painting things, building things, maybe sewing clothes, etc. Yeah,
I bet you would be very good at that. I have all the confidence, but hopefully we don't come to that one. But even what you're talking about, the one example that comes to my mind is the Fallout series video game TV show. Even in that one, they go to bottle caps. Like, they're like, hey, these are things, and they're still a coin. They're still an agreed upon in a dystopian society. They're still an agreed upon currency that they do. And it's not just bartering.
Yeah.
Speaking of currency, and we're on a tech podcast, it would be a crime not to talk about cryptocurrency.
Say that again, because you were laughing as you were saying it. I mean, cryptocurrency.
Cryptocurrency, yes, yeah. So you're talking about not necessarily having a central bank. And this is what these guys want us to, you know, really aspire to. So what do you think? Will it work? I mean, it is now, it does convey value. Like, people are transacting with these cryptocurrencies and all of that.
Yeah,
but
people are also just making random ones, and then they are engaging in pump and dump schemes and kind of just using them as scams as well. So, no, I'm pro central bank. I am happy that there is a central bank. I am all right with the U.S. having its ability to regulate financial markets and to provide liquidity to banks. I think all of those things are very important. If we're talking about kind of crypto from the ground up, I think that the sort of hash functions and sort of there are some really interesting things about crypto, especially about Bitcoin, for instance. But overall, I think that the market is kind of over. Maybe it's a concept of something in the future, but a completely deregulated system that isn't that useful for most of us. Maybe the answer is yet. Maybe that's what it is. But it's become a place where you see transactions of either criminal nature or of sort of desire. Like, I really want this to work. And I get that. I get having a dream. But it's also where we see a lot of scammers now as well, like in trying to prey upon people that just want to get in on the next big fad, that want to make money easily but don't really know what they're doing. And they're just basically trying to suck money out of the people they think of as bag holders. And that's not right. That's not an efficient distribution of our resources. I don't think so. And I think that overall our financial system needs to be more trustworthy, that there are reasons that we ask for banks to hold on to a certain amount in reserves. There are reasons that we try to pay attention to what kind of loans are being made out there. In general, I do not support the kind of exploitation of folks that don't know a ton of stuff about a particular market. They might be well informed about other things, but in this particular instance, there's something they don't know. I don't think that just because you don't, you know, you're not an expert in crypto means that you should be fleeced.
So is that the fundamental difference, like preventing exploitation and regulation? For example, if there's a fraudulent transaction on my credit card, I make a phone call and it's done, right? So there's an authority that can protect me. But is that the fundamental difference? So as far as I know, you don't have that. For example, Bitcoin transactions. If someone steals your Bitcoin, you're out of luck and it's gone. Because there is, and it's by design. So is that the fundamental difference that you're saying, that why it's not good?
Maybe. Yeah, that it's essentially, I mean, so someone can't steal your Bitcoin by faking a sale, for instance, but they could steal Bitcoin by stealing your Bitcoin wallet, by essentially hacking you that way.
Yeah. Just like stealing my credit
Just
card.
Just like stealing your, yeah.
Yeah.
But yes, you can. There's no backsies in that sort of a way, unless you manage to convince somebody that way. There's also just the rife speculation. Like, we know how much a dollar is worth, and the dollar's worth changes, whether it is changing due to inflation, deflation, whether it's overall just other currencies, kind of that exchange rate changing overall. But there's something else in Bitcoin, which is the idea of it as a potential like investment. If you think about
Okay.
it, people might hold cash at home because they think they will need cash, but you don't make cash an investment. And so I think it's something about that as well, that there is not a ton of oversight, that there is speculation about its value. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Anna, I came into this conversation excited, and I've been blown away and learned, and I'm always grateful to learn, especially from people like yourself. So thank you for sharing that with me. But I want to end the conversation with something a little bit broader, and I might be putting you on the spot here. But if someone was interested in learning more about this, but without pursuing a PhD or without enrolling in a class and starting with micro and macro, are there anything that you read that gives a good concept, kind of keeps you up on current events without maybe a political side or a partisan nature to it? Some places that you trust for your information beyond Freakonomics. That's basically where I'm trying to go. Not trying to throw shade on them, but I think a lot of them are like, I've read Freakonomics, so I'm good. Like.
Oh, that's a really tough question, Russ. So I let's see. The Freakonomics book is great. The Freakonomics blog is wonderful. There's the Planet Money podcast.
Oh, I
That's
love that.
a pretty interesting one that can get through quite a lot of economic concepts. The funny thing is obviously when I'm looking more into new economic stories, I'm reading academic journal articles. So I don't really have a lot of layperson's places. But I do listen to a lot of podcasts, be they political podcasts or sometimes just learning more about civic engagement. It's a lot of political podcasts right now.
No way.
And
No. Sorry, I'm joking.
I don't know. I watch a lot of YouTube. I try
I
to,
do
I
love Planet Money, and I was coming back from conference last night. I listened to like 10 episodes on the flight, and
Yeah.
some of this not paying for the damages of climate change came from there, one of their
Yeah. So the funny thing is I don't listen to Planet Money regularly at all. It's more that when I need a
Yeah,
really
it's
good
for me.
explainer or a really
Yeah.
good connection to, like, for my students, I'll be like, hey, look, this is like the perfect Planet Money podcast. So there, for instance, was a really good one on water usage in California and growing almond trees and essentially the cost of water. And that was like a really good episode that I liked a lot. But there's all sorts of there's all sorts of podcasts about economics.
Anna, again, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. It was a joy. And maybe in a couple of weeks or months, we'll have you back on because there could be some large changes
What?
in our time. I don't know. Like, we'll see. We'll see. Or it could all just be the exact same and we continue to be human and try and figure this out as we go and rely on people like yourself and like me to give us more information to help us understand ourselves. So thank you for your work. Thank you for your efforts.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both. It was a delightful conversation.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by Northern Illinois University, where your future is our focus. And please remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.